Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah, and today we have...
Coach Kelly!
Coach Kelly is remote today, but it looks like we have her on. I'm very excited. So you were just saying, Kelly, that you were in...
I was Solvang, California. It's this cute little Danish town. We are driving up the coast. We're going to go to Carmel, my husband and I.
Wonderful. I'm envious, but in a very good way. So in place of you, Kelly, because you're not in your seat, I am sitting in your seat, and in my seat is a very, very special colleague, friend, longtime friend of mine, Mr. Jack Nelson Saul. He is an eating disorder specialist, and I'm going to introduce him more fully in a moment, but say hi, Jack.
Hi, Jack.
No hijacking. No, don't say that.
No, sorry. Hi, Kelly. Hi, Deb. How are you doing?
So, you know, before I recap from last week's show, I think it's really important that we talk about this little trio of ours, because it is because of Jack that Kelly and I met.
Yes.
It's amazing, right? So I met Jack, I think we were talking about this a little bit before, about 25 years ago. I was working at an eating disorders facility. It was like a hospital called A Place for Us downtown. And I was working with morbidly obese patients. And there was a guy that was running the place, and he was the director. His name was Bill. And Bill and I were talking one day. He goes, you know, you have to meet my friend Jack. I'm like, I'm always interested in networking and meeting somebody. And we just instantly bonded. I mean, it was amazing.
It was wonderful. Bill and I had gone back a little while also. And he was a mentor and a therapist, and he was very active and involved in the eating disorder world, as you became and as I became.
Yeah, and we started having lunch almost weekly. My daughter was a little munchkin, and we would go to a deli, and Tiffany would sit there. She called Jack Uncle Jack, because he was so close in our lives, so she only knew him as Uncle Jack. And my little daughter, who is the most healthiest person on the planet now when it comes to food, ordered the biggest hot dog and french fries
every time.
That was bigger than her.
Absolutely.
But she was good, wasn't she?
She had a good portion of it.
She also would sit there and just listen to us, like mesmerized by our conversation. It was hysterical. So that was when she was like 3 and 4 years old, all the way till she was like six or seven. So then fast forward, Jack and I were having lunch. Kelly, you found Jack somehow, right? Tell us your...
Yes, exactly. So I found Jack through somebody I know who I said, you know, hey, I would love to... I'm looking into radio, and I would love to talk to people who have done radio. And she's like, you know, I have a friend, Jack, who really knows everybody. That's kind of how she approached it. And I said, all right, great. I'm up. And same thing. I instantly clicked with Jack. He was so personable. And I think when we met for coffee, I think like he knew three of the people who had walked into the Starbucks. So I'm like, all right, this guy's definitely connected. And he gave me the names of a few people who were in radio. And one of them was you. And yeah, and Deborah and I completely clicked immediately. And it was like, you know, love at first sight. We hit it off, and all because of Jack.
I love doing that stuff. I love making matches with people who need, kind of cosmically and spiritually, need to be together. And so I hooked the two of them up, as I love doing, and the rest is history, as they say.
Yes, and I loved what Jack called himself earlier before the show, as I was trying to get rid of some of his spilkas, as they call them, hands in the pants. He called himself a networking whore. Is this amazing? I love it.
I can't believe you can say that on radio.
You can say anything you want on this radio. We are completely uncensored.
Unbelievable.
For the fact that we are psychologists and therapists, that we do have to protect our patients' anonymity and privacy. Otherwise,
we can ruin our own reputations as much as we want.
Exactly.
Great. Trash each other and ourselves. Great.
So, you are now introduced to my favorite networking whore, Mr. Jack Saul.
I am honored, I think, to be called that. By you. Just by you.
You're welcome. Too. So, Jack, tell us a little bit about your practice, where you practice, and how you got into the wonderful world of eating disorders. And then I'm going to share a little personal story as well.
Magnificent, Deb. I was doing two other things. I came from a law background, and I was in the insurance business. And I did some soul searching and some introspection, met some people along the way. I used to weigh 300 pounds, and I haven't in over 30 years. And one thing led to another, and I volunteered in a 12-step eating disorder hospital program back in 1982. And I just loved what I saw. They hired me from a volunteership to a full employee, and they strongly suggested I go back to graduate school, which initially I wasn't particularly excited about. But the study of psychology, family systems, and a little bit of eating disorders was just magnificent. And I stayed working at that hospital program for 6 years. And that really formed the foundation of my love for and my affinity toward working with the entire spectrum of eating disorders. But as I've gotten older, I think I'm more apt to be drawn towards working with compulsive overeaters, binge eaters, and the obese because of my own personal background.
Wow. How did you lose the weight?
Which time?
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I like wait. Oprah's not in studio, is she?
No. Don't get me started. I like to keep my license just the way it is. I lost 100 pounds in college, and like many people with that affinity, that talent, that issue, after I lost all the weight, I lost over 100 pounds in a short amount of time by conventional, silly, totally unhealthy dieting, but I lost the weight. And I gained it all back in graduate school, not in psych grad school, but in law school. And there's not a worse feeling than weighing 300 pounds, than losing it all, having the illusion for a moment in time that no symptom, no problem. And as I tell the story, I got a new suit and a new new girlfriend, a new car, and a new briefcase, and thought the problem was over, only to find out that insidiously it lurked behind almost every corner, and I gained it all back.
Wow. You know, interesting, because I didn't recap from last week, but it's a good moment to just remind people that we were talking about grief and loss last week. And actually, when you talk about losing weight, I mean, there would be a grieving process both in the losing it and the gaining it back, right? Because it's sort of a change in your, it's like a shedding of
skin. That's a great point.
Absolutely. A couple of things. Number one is many of the clients that I've worked with have talked about the grief inherent in losing their best friend. And laugh though we may, and
food.
All the social, absolutely,
food, yeah.
Food absolutely, mm-hmm. And their whole relationship with food. I mean,
their comfort.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of very adaptive functioning to the overeating and to the overweight. It may destroy us and kill us emotionally, physically, and spiritually, but there is a lot of adaptive function to it. It serves some valuable function in staying afloat. And it's
and
only
coping
like, and cope absolutely and it, there's so many different things, whether it's coping or rewarding or soothing or punishing or making space between us and others, whether it's setting boundaries. For the bulimic, it's often a very hostile aggressive action. I mean, it's not just a symptom unrelated to the whole core and essence of who the person is, and that's whether the person is 15, 20 pounds overweight, possibly, but certainly 300. And I've worked with people up to 700 pounds in treatment centers. And their issues are not necessarily greater, but once they hit a point, it kind of takes over. And their whole life is very much centered around the whole weight phenomena.
It was fascinating as you described that. It's reminding me when I was working at that eating disorder facility, and there was a woman that was, I think she was something like 670 pounds, somewhere in there. She was so large that she actually could not get out of bed, and she was actually bedbound because her body took over all of it. And so if she had to get up, she needed like three helpers to be able to get her up. They didn't even have a wheelchair that could support her weight. And it was just, her life was so small, which is so interesting. She was so large and her life was so small.
That's a great point. But another point even in line with that is I once conducted a group with five morbidly obese, middle-aged. I called them middle-aged then. As I've gotten older, they're not so middle-aged anymore.
No, you're only 4 and a half, right?
4 and a half.
Yeah, because I'm still 3.
Oh, yeah, you're still 3.
Yeah, and Kelly, how old are you? You're probably 1 and a half, right? Yeah, okay.
I'm not even born yet.
Okay.
So there were 5 overweight, compulsive overeating women on the right side of a group of 10 women. There were 5 anorexic, bulimic women on the left side, and then me. And I was pretty raw and new in this. And I'm thinking, dear God, how's this going to go? And one of the obese women turned to one of the bulimics and said, you know something, sweetheart? I don't mean to be disrespectful or rude, but you're so pretty. You're so young. You're so intelligent. I don't understand why you throw up. And I'm sitting there shaking, thinking, oh, dear God, how's this going to go? And that bulimic woman didn't skip a beat. And she looked back at the woman and said, no disrespect meant back at you, ma'am, but look at you. I don't understand why you don't throw up. Ooh. And for the next hour and a half, these 10 women who would have every reason to think they were different than each other had a magnificent group that really needed no facilitation as they talked about their pain, which was similar, their issues, mm-hmm. which oft times are similar. And it was just an amazing thing when they look for the reasons to make themselves similar rather than look for reasons to be different.
Well, I think it's fascinating that eating disorder clinics treat, you know, the whole gamut together.
They often do. But there are some treatment centers.
Bulimics, you know. Yeah.
Well, some of them don't. Some of them work primarily with anorexics and bulimics. And some of them are more known for or most comfortable with working with the obese / binge eating, or again, I call it compulsive overeating.
There's value in putting everyone together to a degree because it does teach empathy. It helps both ends of the spectrum really get a greater understanding of what the dynamic is more deeply because, you know, we judge a book by its cover. Well, if you're overweight and I'm underweight, how could you understand anything? But actually, as Jack's saying, at the core, there's so many similar dynamics and issues and fears that are all being conjured up. But there's also some value in doing some separate work as well, particularly in the new stages, because sometimes people are just very hostile toward the other end of the spectrum.
Which then later in treatment often serves well when they put men and women in the same units, because then many of the women will have issues that they project on to some of the men in the treatment center. And in theory, in a therapeutically safe and healthy environment, those issues can be ferreted out, worked out, and worked through. And each patient can deal with the projections of other, because in the real world, they probably will have occasion to need to interact with a little bit of everything and everybody.
If you just tuned
in. That makes
sense. Oh, sorry, Kelly, didn't mean to step on you there. I can't step on you. You're too far away, actually.
I thought it was interesting that you pointed out that she's in a place where there's a lot of Danish, and then we wound up talking about eating issues.
There you go. Yeah, are you eating those wonderful pastries?
There's a correlation everywhere.
You know, I remember those pastries because my parents used to go to Solvang all the time when I was a little girl. We saw more of that Danish town than any other town around except for Santa Barbara. And
really?
I still remember, Kelly, if you're there, they still have these tiny little pastries. They are just pure sugar. I mean, they're so awful.
Great.
They're just,
my kids would go nuts for that.
Your kids would love them. It's like just diving into a just like rock solid lard and sugar.
And we wonder why there's a society filled with eating issues.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Dr. Deborah, Coach Kelly, and our very special guest, Jack Saul. And remember, it's you who make our show, so please give us a call with any of your questions. But if you have a question about food, body image, eating issues, then we're here for that too today. 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. And of course, we always love your emails. For those who are a bit shyer, you can always email us. So I'll tell a little bit of my personal story because it's still, you know, I use it all the time in terms of trying to really put my arms around when somebody's really struggling with these things. So what's interesting is I've said this many times on air, and Kelly knows this, and you know this too, Jack. You know a lot about my history. My father, being a Holocaust survivor, had a very interesting dynamic around food, right? There was the fear of getting fat because wanting to fit into this American culture and be, you know, grow affluently and be strong, et cetera. So he had this tremendous fear of getting fat, but wanted to eat, right? Because eating was such a rare commodity. Now, my mother, who was a model in Canada at the time, of course, was all about being emaciated. So I had these two parents who were absolutely obsessed with body weight. And they had a little scale in a tiny little closet downstairs. And I used to have to weigh in the dark. And there's this little light that my mother would pull on. And if you were like a half a pound more than you were, then, you know, all bets were off in terms of what you could eat, what you were allowed to eat. So I remember when I was...
Really?
Yeah, it was kind of frightening. It was a little bit like being, you know, in a concentration camp. It was very strange. And they didn't have any insight or awareness. Now, by the way, they weren't doing this to be mean. I just know that this was their issues, but so obsessed with it that I remember I was like a beanpole. Like, my nicknames were Skinny Bones Jones and all that stuff. And I probably put on about 5 pounds after puberty, maybe 10 pounds, and I looked like a young woman now. I walked by in the hall, and my father was there, and he says, "Boy, are you getting fat." And from that moment on, it was launched me into a full-fledged anorexic, and then following, because I couldn't just handle the starvation all the time, bulimic episode for years. It was very progressive. It was very horrible. It was just so painful. And, you know,
how old were you?
I'm going to say, well, pretty much from 14 to about 22 or 23. I mean, it lasted a really long time. I mean, then I turned to some drugs because if you have stimulants, then they cause you to not want to eat as much. So, you know, it was a really hard cycle. And interestingly, because in our culture, people would say, "Oh, you look so good. You're getting so skinny." Like, that was not healthy. I went down to 89 pounds at 5'7".
Oh, my
God. That's frightening. Yeah. And they didn't even notice. They didn't notice.
And these are kind of the issues that can be looked at in a therapeutic milieu, whether it's individual therapy or a treatment center. And it doesn't mean that there were objective traumas, or oftentimes there are, but there were subjective traumas to which each person reacts however they react. And those are the kind of issues which get to or have to be looked at by somebody in, if you will, recovery.
Kelly, did we just lose you?
No, I just put it on mute because it was loud. I was going over a bridge and it was really loud. I was like, I didn't want to.
There you are. Okay.
Mess anything up.
Yeah, good point, Jack. Very, very good point. So, do you notice really significant differences between, let's say, males and females in terms of their body image issues? And do you see any trend now, a greater trend in men with the more serious forms of anorexia and bulimia?
When I got into the field 30 years ago, it was really top-heavy towards female. I mean, the patients in the inpatient world, it was all female. And then little by little by little, the gay male population seemed to enter into the experience. It seems like there was a lot of focus on aesthetics, appearance, body image, and things like that, which theretofore had been unique to the heterosexual female world. Over time, it's become, in my practice, an equal opportunity disease, if you will. And I think there are way more male bulimics and anorexic than there ever used to be. But also, the whole phenomenon of eating disorders amongst men has been often underreported, more so than not existing. And so as the gay community gets to use the phrase coming out, and I think a lot of what recovery is about is coming out with one's secrets, with their reality, whether it's sexual or most of the time it's not, but whatever the issues are, to kind of come out, tell the truth, and look scrutinizingly at those issues which get in the way of the person optimally functioning. So... yeah, it's way more an equal opportunity. Same thing with anorexia and bulimia. It used to be only young, upper middle class, white females. Mm. And over time, that's not unique to that population anymore either.
I can't remember the specific study, but I remember like 10 years ago reading an article in one of the journals that there was some study that they did with some small island, I don't know if it's like near Fiji or something, where they didn't have television yet. And then when they introduced television, something like 30% of the female population ended up with some form of an eating disorder. Now, obviously, we can't directly draw cause and effect on that one because there could have been all kinds of intervening variables. But I think it's a pretty powerful and significant statement about how much the media and the representation of how people look on television and magazines and how much that really, certainly as a young female, I mean, remember Cosmopolitan and Glamour and all this, why we had loved to read those. It was all about this never-ending comparison in my head. It was like being in a perpetual beauty contest all the time
and, when you're
and
in
never
big,
winning.
Well, you're in, and you're in the big city like L.A. and New York and a lot of other cities, the pressure is just outrageous.
Huge,
on men and
well,
and women.
I was going to say that because coming from the East Coast, you know, I've moved back and forth several times and I've been in, you know, D.C. the last 5 years and I came back and I was like, oh my God, like there's a huge difference that I see. There's a lot more competition. It's like, you know, you've got to like, it's like one up the Jones, you know, to come.
Yeah,
I don't want to pass it all off, though, as cultural and societal.
For sure.
But I can't downplay and minimize the significance of that component. But quite often, it's a compilation of a lot of things and family of origin, if you will, issues, one's background. And it's not about blame. That's the other thing. A lot of clients are reticent to go on this exploration because they fear blaming. And it's really not about shifting blame. It's not about blame at all. It's about seeing the context in which some of these feelings and then the process by which people deal or don't deal with the feelings and to be able to develop more healthy a toolbox, as you mentioned before, a healthier toolbox on ways to cope with the reality of whatever they're dealing with or feeling.
And it is a journey. It is quite a very in-depth process to go through with self-discovery and not blame and not want to cast, you know, yourself in a victim position. You know, yes, in some ways children are victimized because, you know, you've got who you got in front of you. And that's pretty much the lot. You don't get to just wake up one day and say, you know, I don't like the way you're parenting me, Mom and Dad. I'm going to go somewhere else. You know, some kids run away, etc. But for the most part, we stay stuck where we are. But as we get to become adults, it's ever so important that we start claiming responsibility for our actions in the present. Otherwise, we end up re-victimizing ourselves and holding ourselves hostage to our eating disorders, our addictions, our obsessions, our compulsions, because we don't feel like we have any power to choose.
And we have way more power than we ever thought. And I think the people that get stuck are the ones who are reluctant to blame and have a difficult time assuming the adult responsibilities inherent in developmentally growing up. And so it's I'm not real big on the just do it or the put on the big boy pants and all that silly stuff. It's about grieving. It's about the developmental process. If it was waylaid along the way, like in my case, my mother died when I was 14. No matter what issues I had before that, all hell broke loose, both around me, but inside me. And I was, I would say, stunted at that point. It's not about intelligence, because I was always reasonably intelligent. It's not about entitlement, because I wasn't less or more entitled because my mom had died. But I had issues which I had no way of addressing in a healthy way. And that's when the food and, there go the weight, became monumental issues. And it wasn't until I entered in my own introspective therapeutic recovery process that some of these things became clear and being able to move on from them eventually became possible.
Yeah. You know, I love listening to you talk, Jack, because I can tell anybody who's listening, if you have any of these issues, you know, you really need a therapist who is very compassionate, and Jack is that, and who's very attuned with what these issues are. And it's just beautiful to hear you speak this way. Usually when we're out having lunch, you're a kibitzer and a half. It's one joke after the next. I'm usually like peeing in my pants by the end of...
Which is something else we should talk about.
Yes.
There's a lot of restaurants they won't let us back into.
You know, but in listening to you really describe your work and your understanding, it's beautiful. So
thank you.
Thank you for being on this planet. Thank you for having come into the field to share your wisdom and your compassion, because it's really lovely.
Well, thank you. And the gift that the universe, I mean, what I feel compelled to give back is the miracle that I see recovery to be. Who gets chosen for it? Who gets to go on that path, for whom, when, why, how. I'm not always sure. I know people who are deserving and never get it. But we all, the good news is it's not zero sum. Me getting it is not at the expense of somebody else. Recovery is available. It's miraculous, but it is available, and it's there for the grabbing, though oftentimes not without a fair amount of blood, sweat, and tears. Not easy. Simple, but not easy.
Yeah.
But doable.
If you just tuned in, you are listening to Dr. Debra, Coach Kelly, who's now in solving, and our wonderful guest, Jack Saul, who's an eating disorder expert. And we are talking about body image and eating disorders and issues such as those. Please give us a call at 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. We do love your calls, and we're happy to answer any of your questions. Hey, Jack, because I could pick your brain here. You know, there's probably as many diets out there as there are cereals on the shelf, right? Cereal brands.
Yes.
And we all know,
I was
for the most part,
a cereal dieter.
You were a cereal dieter? That's good. There's the Jack I know.
I never understood why there was things as cereal murderers, because I didn't know why anybody would want to murder cereal. I mean, it's such a benign phenomenon.
That's He's a good back. One. He's back. The Spilkas are gone, and the humors. The networking whore is
now.
Well, you know what fine is? Fucked up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional.
Oh, and I don't even drink, and I'm fine. No.
Anyway, so the diet stuff.
I don't know much about them, Deb. To be honest with you, I'm just going to cut you off. I mean, there are dietitians, registered dietitians, and people who really specialize in the phenomena of weight loss and how to do it and what's the healthiest way to do it. And though there's probably lots of controversy, there's probably some pretty accepted protocol on what to do and what not to do. What I found is that for eating issues, it's not about losing the weight. Of course, I'm not oblivious to that. It's about, look, the alcoholic who wants sobriety has to stop drinking. And for certain of those diseases, alcohol, drug addiction, gambling, it's black and white. If you're in recovery, you don't pick up, you don't use, you don't gamble, end of deal. But certain of the diseases, again, I mean, putting up air quotes, whether it's work addiction, work addicts do not give up working in recovery. Sex addicts don't have to give up sex in recovery. Compulsive overeaters don't give up eating. Codependents don't give up people. But they have to be able to be in relationship in a healthy way with their substance of choice. Then, like, I have a food plan that I stick to. Then I can set aside the food as not being the issue. The food is not the issue. When the food is not in order, it seems like the food is the only issue. But recovery is about getting that food sufficiently in order so as to allow one to deal with the issues underlying the food. And so it's not about the weight loss, nor it's about which food plan to be on. That is important, but it's not part of the, per se, my understanding of the therapeutic process of recovery from those kinds of issues.
Beautifully said.
Right. So to recap, so you're basically saying it's how to cope.
When you don't use food. In fact, for example, I eat three meals.
With your issues, it's not so much about the food. Right.
There's a friend of mine who used to say it is about the food, and it's not about the food, and it is about the food,
and it's not about the food.
The first time she said that, I'm writing it down like a schmuck, and I'm thinking, that's profound. And then I turned to her and said, what the hell does that mean? And she pointed out again, she was the one who said, when the food is in order, it's a recovery. When an alcoholic isn't drinking anymore, they're in a position to apparently work their 12 steps if they're going the AA route. I don't think the 12 steps per se tells them how to stop drinking. It's a prerequisite to working of the 12 steps.
Sure.
And then those 12 steps and all that can come from that is really what their growth, their recovery, their healing, and them reaping the benefits of a 12-step program. That's what it's about.
Yeah, you're describing something. A long time ago, I wrote a paper and then did a lecture on it, and I called it "I'm Hungry But Not for Food."
You
and that's so much
I like
of
that.
Where I think early on in childhood, you know, culture, parents, people, we feed children when they're not hungry because we don't want them to feel the feelings that we're uncomfortable with. So then we make our children uncomfortable with their feelings, and then they don't have a resource for how to live as a normal, healthy human being.
Right now, in some families...
Well, remember...
Go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to say, remember, we had the grief expert on last week, and he was saying that a lot of times parents, you know, the kids will be grieving, and it's like, oh, it's okay. Here, have a donut, or let's go for ice cream. Like, let's just cover up your feelings, because A, I'm uncomfortable, and I know this will make you happy. So let's not deal with the feeling. Let's just, you know, cover it up.
Absolutely. I see here on some of the notes from hearing about what you spoke about last time, Deb, that Russell Friedman gave the six myths. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, one of the other ones is the effect that food can have or not have and how it should be used. It's not meant to be a soother. I mean, it's not a replacement for a baby, per se, for the breast and the nurturing of a loving, empathic, compassionate, available, say, arguably historically, mother. It's not designed for that, and yet it's often put in the position of having to be used for that.
Right. Makes sense.
And for some, constantly. I mean, that is one of the only resources that parents provide for their children in terms of what to do when they're uncomfortable.
So it's also modeled for families that eat poorly, but quite often some of the families I've worked with, it's not about what they modeled physically. It's more an attitude. What's that great line, Deb? What you're doing speaks so loudly, I can't hear what you're saying. So they may even teach the right things in theory, but how they're living, and that's, again, the psychological and the emotional components are really, really relevant.
Absolutely. Hey, I think it would be, we did get a couple of emails this last week that I think would be perfect for, since our guest Jack is here to help us answer.
Yes.
So I'm going to go ahead and read one. You up for that, Jack?
Absolutely.
All right, you're on,
If I don't
Jack.
Like it, I'm passing it back to you.
That's it.
Well, give it to Kelly. She's not here to defend herself.
Hot potato.
I have the emails if you want me to read them too, so just FYI.
Okay. All right, here we go. Dear hosts, I'm 20 pounds heavier since giving birth to my beautiful little boy 2 years ago. I've been trying to lose the extra weight through diet, etc., but I haven't really been all that motivated. I'm usually so exhausted at the end of the day that having some chocolate cookies or something yummy is all I can think about. My husband tries to be motivating, but I usually just cave into the temptation, and before it's too late, I've already downed several hundred calories too many. Is this normal for a mom who has very little help? By the way, I also have no interest in having sex anymore, and I'm sure my husband is feeling lonely, though he never complains. Signed, full belly and sexless.
Well, why don't you handle the first part, Deb, which is about the inherent phenomena of a female's body and psyche after having a child.
Well, absolutely. There can be so many hormonal things that are going on. Also, you know, back to that subject of grief, I now look at almost every situation and see the grieving and the loss aspect of it, because as Russell had defined it, it's about a significant change and conflict around the feelings that get put in front of us when there are these big changes or losses of hopes, dreams, and expectations. And so this woman being pregnant can be such a glorious time in somebody's life. You know, very little is expected of you. You get special attention. You get special favors. Now you have to do the job. Now the baby's here, and she knows she's probably is exhausted, doesn't have a lot of help, and she could have some signs of postpartum depression is possible, but it also sounds like she has certainly been somebody who's turned to, as she calls it, yummy treats or yummy foods to help soothe some of the unhappiness or maybe anxiety that she has about the changes in her relationship with her husband, with her own sense of womanhood, her part about her body. So I'm going on and on here. Somebody else chime in.
Well, the other thing is I know that in L.A. and the other a lot of, you know, big cities nowadays, therapy is a acceptable, cool, a tolerable option. In a lot of places, it's not. And to acknowledge that, that one needs help or wants help or might benefit from help is considered almost a character flaw. In reality, we all need to be heard and gotten and seen and understood. And of all populations that come to mind that needs plenty of that is a mother after having a baby. And so they'll be lost.
Absolutely.
There's loss of sleep, loss of the way the life was before. And the husband is probably feeling some of that also. It's And are they talking about that? The other problem with the mate trying to step in, and I mean, it's a fine line as a family member of somebody who's a food user or abuser, because it can also set up problems by even the mere suggestion, or it's a very precarious balance between being empathic and compassionate and not being too invested in squeezing somebody to do what indeed would be better for them, but they can't do it. And all of a sudden it sets up their people-pleasing. Yeah. The wife can be accommodating to be liked. And then it sets up a resistance and a rebellion, which means an acting out. And the dance continues. So it's not an easy process.
Well, I think also, so, I mean, it sounds like when I hear this email that this woman clearly needs another tool at the end of the day. And so it's like, I just feel like if I were to talk with her face-to-face, I would say, well, what else can you do to replace that? Because clearly you're needing some sort of love. Especially being a new mom, like you're caring for somebody, you're giving so much. And so it sounds like she's craving that sort of joy for herself at the end of the day. And so she needs to replace that tool, with something special for her, whether that be, a bath at the end of the day, getting a manicure, just having some time for her so she can feel that sense of self again.
Could also be a double-edged sword in this one, too, as you were saying, Jack, about a mate or somebody significant other participating in that process, because, boy, he could be motivating, and then she could think, well, he thinks I'm fat, and if he thinks that I'm fat, and oy, 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 that vicious cycle, and I fear that we just lost a caller. I think I didn't notice this in time. If you did just call at 323-203-0815, and you're still listening, please call right back. I promise to answer. I was so mesmerized and wrapped up in all that we were talking about that I just looked at the screen and I think it went off. So my bad. Please call back because we do love your calls. Again, 323-203-0815. You're listening to Dr. Deborah, Coach Kelly, and our wonderful friend guest, Jack Saul. And we are talking about food and body image and weight and what it all means. And it's such a big subject, isn't it?
You know what comes to mind also is that the notion of needing support. Again, I can't label this woman a compulsive eater because I don't have enough information.
Sure.
I would never diagnose somebody that I don't know or know well, my family notwithstanding. but that being said, the idea of having a support group, I know a lot of people have found. I was listening to a doctor, an MD doctor, talking about alcohol recovery, and he said as many magnificent tools as the medical world has for recovering alcoholics, he said the people in Alcoholics Anonymous can give them a few things that the medical model is not designed to give them, one of them being, quote, spirituality, whatever that may connote to somebody, but the other is community. And I'm sure that this woman is not in reality alone in her feelings that come up, because to say the least, there's no shortage of I guess Deborah and I were talking before about the word Landsmann. It's a German or Yiddish word meaning men of the people of the same land. And that's one of the values that, for example, a 12-step program can be for people, is a place to go, meet other people like kind, and to get an empathic, compassionate response across the board. So just something to think about, that you get some social interaction, and 12-step program is like Overeaters Anonymous.
I think that sounds great.
May even be an option.
Yeah, I think one of the saddest parts about our culture, certainly out in this area, is the lack of community in childcare. So many people who the only option that they have are expensive babysitters is what they say. It's like, I can't have any time for myself because I don't have a sitter, and we can't have a sitter because it costs too much money, and therefore it's all about me. But that loss of, sort of community connectedness with, other mothers and other fathers, and I don't know, I'm all about like co-op babysitting, finding a couple families with similar aged children and who you can actually tolerate and rotate, like once a month. If you have four families, you've got childcare once a month. Then you've got your Saturday night off three times a month.
I know this is overused, but when they talk to people about how you have to take care of yourself before you can take care of others, they always give the example of the airplane with the mask
dropping the oxygen.
So if the parents are depleted and can't or for any other reason don't have the availability of giving in certain ways or in certain amounts, then the kid will be affected by that. So the better at some level the parents can self-care, the better off ultimately the baby will be.
Yes,
100%.
Which is why Kelly is in Solvang.
Right. Taking care of her inner child.
Yes. Well, her two young kids are probably tearing up the house.
I was just going to say, that's exactly why. Yeah. You know, it's so funny because when I was leaving, my older one was saying, like, no, don't go. It was like the kid guilt trip, you know? And I, like, thought about it for a minute of actually bringing him along. It was like that moment of, like, and then I was like, no, it's so important for your mate. And, you know.
Yes.
Did I lose you guys?
Nope.
Oh, good. You're still there.
You're there.
Okay, good.
Yes, yes.
So it is. It's so important. Then I can come back refreshed. Same with my husband, and we have more to give.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, that's another issue for, especially, again, my affinity is working with compulsive overeaters, setting boundaries lovingly.
Yes.
Setting boundaries is not about being aggressive or being abusive. It's anything but that. It's about appropriately conveying the reality of one's preferences and needs in an empathic, compassionate, hearable manner. It's not designed to be an affront.
Yes.
In fact, that's aggressive. Aggressive is designed, I win, you lose.
Mm.
Passive is, I lose, I don't matter anyway,
right.
You win. But assertive is in theory.
And passive aggressive is really screwed up.
Really screwed up, but we don't judge. But assertive is ideally a win-win. I mean, it very much can be that. And you know, I've been accused of being a little naive. I'm not overly optimistic. I don't know. I think I'm a realist. But boundaries have to be set,
yeah.
and they have to be set effectively and lovingly. The price paid by people who don't set them is that they can have resentments, they can act out, they can other-destruct, or they can self-destruct.
You know, it's curious, most people, when they talk about boundaries, they're talking about it in the context of what to do with others, but setting loving boundaries with oneself is just as important as setting loving boundaries with other people, because, you know, we do need to learn how to soothe and take care of our inner child or our inner being or all the little parts of us that want to run rampant and create havoc, you know, all the little tiny gremlins we have within us.
You know what? It's an interesting construct because I wait until I don't introduce the construct of self-parenting until I know the mm-hmm. audience. And so I'm glad that you brought that up. I like the construct. I read a great book many years ago, and I keep buying 5 and 10 copies of the book and then loaning them to clients or people and never seeing them again.
Of course not.
I could write my name.
Which one?
It's called Self-Parenting.
Uh-huh.
And it happens.
Oh, self-parenting.
Yeah, and it looks like it's a book for kids,
mm-hmm.
and
uh-huh.
it looks so silly with big print and pictures. But one of the lines that really got me, the guy who wrote it was Dr. Jonathan Pollard, and he said, "We will self-parent like the worst features of what we got." And my first reaction was, "Oh, dear God, this is not
wow.
a good thing." But we will self-parent like the worst of what we got. And so there really is a kid in there, and you think about eating issues, that's the epitome of child run amok.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
a household run by a child is normally, you know, home alone, movie notwithstanding, is not an effectively functioning household. So
sure.
there's got to be the imposition of structure, whether the kid likes it or not. It's easier to conceptualize when you're talking about adult and a real kid. But I think it's going on inside of us, or many of us who are aware of that internal potential turmoil all the
yeah.
time. And it's how to negotiate it in a healthy way that becomes important.
You said something earlier about the book and loaning them to clients and never getting them back. I actually have a little story about that was in my own life that is really, maybe it'll shed some light because it was really meaningful. My very first therapist, you know, I was dealing with, as I was working through my eating disorder and other issues, I had so much shame. Like my whole center being of my existence was about, I am not worthy, I'm not deserving, I'm not lovable, I don't deserve to have a healthy body, et cetera, et cetera. So she gave me this book that she had on shame. And I swear I held on to that book for 2 years after I stopped seeing her, and I stopped seeing her because, sadly, there were no boundaries in my clinical program in terms of who becomes your supervisor. So they actually had my therapist actually was asked to become the supervisor at the clinic that I was working. So that, of course, destroyed it. But I kept that book for 2 years, and I ran into her at one of the like alumni meetings of this the staff from the clinic, and she says, "You still have that book?" And I said, "You know, I think that book was a transitional object for me. It was my bunkie. It was my pacifier for having to say goodbye to her. And it was really meaningful. It was very meaningful to her." And she says, "Wow, I never thought about it that way. Please keep the book and have it for, you know." And it was a very special moment. And I think that sometimes we don't recognize the importance we have in some of our clients' lives in terms of we may be all they have to some degree. We may be the only empathic, compassionate ear and nodding of the head and giving a smile, almost like mirroring their inner experience that was never done for them. So I think that that could be why people don't give those books back.
And you know, something Deb, the
such a good point.
Well, the therapists I refer to better be, they are what you're describing, Deb. They're empathic, compassionate. I mean, you know, the clients can buy our time, but they can't buy the sincerity and the authenticity of that therapeutic bond and the therapeutic relationship, which is sincere, again, in the only colleagues of mine that I'll refer to.
As you are a networking whore, so like, how do you explain that?
Well, you know what, though? I'm very proud to know that I will find...
Way to lighten up the mood.
Absolutely. I've referred to people and gotten connections, matchmakes, if you will, all over the world, and they always come from people I know or know very, very well and would send a relative or a friend to. Otherwise, I'm not just interested in connecting people off names on a list. This is you have a very honored place, you're right, Deb, in the hearts and souls of our clients, and that we hold the fragility of their soul in our hands, and that's got to be handled respectfully.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, I am kidding you, Jack, but Jack is actually one of the kindest therapists I have ever met in terms of his generosity of sharing his knowledge, his wisdom, his people, his referral list, everything that he has. You write to Jack and you say, "Jack, I need a," and he's on it. He's on it like within an hour.
Exactly.
He's not in session. Yes. It's like, "Oh, I've got somebody for you." He's just so wonderful that way. That's what I've always loved so much about you, Jack.
Well, I love to thank you. I mean, it's sweet to say, and it feels really good to hear. I enjoy that. I enjoy being able to impact people's lives, and plus I'm very grateful. At 300 pounds at 18 years old, I didn't expect to live this long, and I figured 21, 25, something like that, and my life now is absolutely magnificent, and I feel grateful, and part of the responsibility that I've taken on is to be able to give back. I mean, I'm actively involved in the Jewish Big Brothers. I'm actively involved in a lot of places where I get to give back. Absolutely. And it's I don't even see it as an obligation so much as an opportunity.
Necessity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. And sadly, we are running short on time. So, Jack, what would you like everybody to, what's the parting words you'd like people to know? Maybe a little bit about where people can get help, how they find you.
Perfect. Thank you, Deb. My webpage will be up. This is a commitment in a national radio on May 1st. And so that's done. Wow. I feel pressure already. No. If they want to reach me, my office phone is 310-471-2210. If they feel more comfortable emailing me, it's J, like in Jack, N, like my middle name, Nelson, Sol, S, like in Sam, O-L-L, at, don't laugh, AOL.com. I'm a dinosaur. I understand that.
Old school.
They can call. They can email if they have any questions. I'd be glad to. If I'm not the person with whom they should be working, I will make an effort to find them. I work with adults only, over 18, compulsive overeating, eating issues, couples, codependency. I had the good fortune of studying under and working with John Bradshaw for many years, and that exposed me to just an amazing degree of recovery. And I'm in Brentwood, which is West Los Angeles, California. That's it.
That's good.
By email or by phone, give me a call.
Great.
And again, I will love to work with people who call in, but if I'm not the one, I will absolutely do my best to find you somebody who may be better suited for the match.
Yeah, and if you missed out on some of that information about Jack Saul, you can always write to us, to Kelly, Coach Kelly, or
sure.
to me, and we can always send you in his direction. Another great show. Wow, Jack, it's such
yes.
a pleasure to have you on. And Kelly, thank you for taking time out of your self-care to
Aww.
Be participating in the show.
Well, it was a wonderful show. Jack, thank you so much.
Absolutely, Kelly. And Deb, I just appreciate you and what you do in the world, the way you put it out, whether it's in your books, in your therapy work, in your radio stuff, or just in your friendships. You put out good energy in the world, and the world's a better place for it, as other people have the good fortune of interacting with you. So
you usually make me laugh. Now you're making me cry.
So that was a bar. Two guys watching over. Nah, forget it. Forget about it.
All right. Well, we'll say goodbye to our networking whore, Jack Saul, who's actually, more seriously, a wonderful, wonderful therapist, a great man, and a great friend. And Kelly, you have a great rest of your time. And hey, goodbye
Thank
to all
so
of you.
Much.
We love you. And sending hugs. And come on, join us next time.
Yeah, maybe we could talk about boundaries next week.
Okay.
Good.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.